Washington Federal is a bank based in Seattle that operates 235 branches, and it cares deeply about high school sports not only in the Seattle metro area, but across the entire state of Washington. Head to WashingtonFederal.com to learn more or visit your closest branch. Welcome. This is Scorebook Live Today, a podcast about high school sports in the state of Washington. It's Thursday, October 3rd. It's the fifth week of the high school football season in Washington. And today I'm joined, as always, by the usual suspects, analyst, columnist, former NBA player Dan Dickow in Spokane, and fellow reporter Todd Millis in Tacoma. What's keeping you guys busy this week?
The start of the NBA season for me is always fun, and then tracking college basketball. And then for me on the Scorebook Live side, you know, reaching out to a number of high school coaches this week, setting up what we're doing that's new and unique this year, some media days with different leagues, and just kind of, you know, preparing for the high school season.
Yeah, I can't believe we're in the middle of football season, but we're, you know, 3 weeks from really trying to touch bases with some of these coaches and players. We're not that far away from basketball, and you know, I love football, but basketball, you know, is a sport I probably like even a little bit more covering. So, unfortunately, they kind of mesh together there in late November, December, where they're both going on at the same time. But it'll be fun to make that transition, and I'm glad our guy Dan Dickow is starting this stuff early.
Well, I'm going to try to do some heavy lifting early on this year, because I know you guys get out to a ton of games. And so it'll be fun collaborating with the both of you guys as the season goes on.
No kidding, but it's never too early to start planning. Something Todd and I will be all in on by the time the basketball season's already started is the Gridiron Classic, which we are now a week and a half removed from the WIA announcing its new homes, or at least homes for this year for the 2019 State High School Football Championships. They're at three stadiums in the greater Tacoma area, Pierce County, all outdoors, moving away from the, one stadium, the one dome final setting that was the Tacoma Dome for so long and the King Dome before that. So now that we're a bit removed from this, we've been able to kind of take a look at some of the sites around the state that kind of fit the mold of what the WIA is looking for, and you can kind of tell, and in our reporting we've been able to talk to the WIA and how they made their decisions. But Todd, I wanted to ask you, so just in looking at these stadiums that are right around, you know, the 5,000 to 6,000 capacity, they're all outdoor stadiums, which it's early December. If you're looking at just capacity as a factor, in looking around the state, what other stadiums could kind of fit the mold as a site that the association could have used or would have been interesting to look at?
Well, I'm going to try and not get too long-winded on this, because I think the one piece of feedback that I've seen most often since this announcement came down here about 10 days ago was, you know, for the one site, championship site, is, you know, is why couldn't we, why didn't we look at bigger stadiums? Why didn't we look at bigger facilities? And I think if people have gotten used to going into the Tacoma Dome, you know, with its 23,000 capacity and looking around at all those empty seats, granted it's indoors and they've got, you know, nice concession stands and parking and the big dome and all that stuff. And I think they've said, this is what a championship should look like. It's all these seats. And again, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but attendance in the Tacoma Dome was declining, and it wasn't declining over 1 year. This was a steady decline. So if that's the vision that people have, then okay, let's look at some of the bigger capacity stadiums around the state that are, you know, around 10,000 or more. And you tell me which would have been a championship site. I mean, you guys could chime in on this. Joe Albee Stadium. I mean, again, let's throw out all the other factors that the WIA is considering. You know, something that's close to the majority of the membership school, or where they can draw their biggest pool of fans, or weather. Let's just throw all that stuff out and look purely at capacity. Let's look at Memorial Stadium in Seattle. Let's look at Joe Albee Stadium. Those are two options I've heard a lot about. Do we want to go to Joe Albee Stadium and Memorial Stadium when, in fact, that they're so antiquated that each respective city is thinking about tearing them down and rebuilding them? I mean, to me, that doesn't feel like a championship site. So, okay, it's the same reason why I don't consider Stadium Bowl in downtown Tacoma with its concrete seating at 615,000 with way better views as a venue that should have been considered. So what else should we be considering here? You know, Lincoln Bowl has 10,000. It's hosted state track before. Again, antiquated, hard to get to. You know, Olympic Stadium in Aberdeen. I mean, that's the old wooden stadium that everybody likes to go down and watch the rivalry game, the oldest rivalry game in the state. It's, you know, 8,500 to 10,000 people, all wooden stadium, antiquated. You know, Everett Memorial Stadium is the one that I don't hear a lot about. It seats 12,000 people. It's close to Seattle. Maybe that's a site that we should be talking about. You know, there are stadiums that are bigger, but I don't necessarily think that they should be looked at as destination sites. I would rather look at a smaller site, something that's in the 4,500 to 6,000 range that has some space, that has some amenities where you can make it feel like it's a different site. If I were suggesting to the WIAA to look at something seriously, I would look at Tomlinson Stadium, which was just renovated over in Ellensburg. They had the 4A, 3A All-State game there. It's in the center of the state. It's a nice new facility. You can have all these different things around the stadium for vendors and sponsors and you know, all the things that you could do to make a good football game. And you could bring in 6,000, 7,000 people. To me, that's the stadium I think people should be talking about if they were going to look at a one-stop shop that's financially feasible. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that, you know, I've taken away from seeing some of these comments over the last week or so is the fact that it's easy to complain about something after somebody else has to make a tough decision. And in this situation, you make these comments and you complain about it after not having gone to state championships probably for quite some time. And so it's always easy, you know, to make a complaint as opposed to be a part of the solution. But if we want to talk solutions, I really like what you're talking about there, Todd, is kind of maybe a slightly smaller setting where you can make it feel full, where you can have, for lack of a better term, the festival or fair type vendors on the outside and make it feel like a special and unique experience, which quite frankly it should be, because it's a state championship. But, you know, at the end of the day, what I've kind of understood from the WIA's perspective is, look, we know there's not a perfect venue, a perfect site at this moment in time. Let's try this because of the limiting factors that were happening at the Tacoma Dome and the limiting factors that we have with availability of other places. Let's try this. Let's see how it goes. We can and will adjust from there. Am I right with that?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that last week on the podcast. I totally agree with you, Dan. I think we got to give this a chance. I think we got to, you know, I know there's not a lot of trust right now in the WIA, given sort of the decline of some of the state tournaments and some of the fan experience. We have a different venue, a different perspective. I think Mick's a bright guy. I think he's brought in a couple people with fresh ideas. I think we got to give this a chance, whether it's a year or a couple years, just for them to get kind of feedback. And then we go from there. I mean, maybe we're going from the one extreme in the Tacoma Dome to a different extreme, three small stadiums. Let's just kind of collect data, see what works with the fans, and go from there. But you're right. It's so much easier to complain, especially on social media, about what, you know, again, more complaining, less solutions. And people have given suggestions of different stadiums and different plans and whatnot. And I appreciate people who care about that enough to say, hey, let's look at Memorial. Hey, let's look at Everett Memorial. Or hey, let's look at Joe Albee or something. But, you know, at the end of the day, there are so many factors that I think the general public doesn't take into consideration. again, let's just trust the WI to see, you know, in this direction, and we'll just go from there.
Josh Hart at the Columbian, sports reporter there, put together an interesting thread on Twitter where he kind of looked at each state and where each state hosts their state title football games, and it just really runs the gamut. I mean, the smallest is Vermont's, according to him. Vermont's Rutland High alumni football field was the smallest at 2,000 capacity, and of course the biggest is Jerry World, Texas's AT&T Stadium, where in Texas they play in a house that fits 100,000. So it's, you know, it's easy to look at things like that and the 11 NFL venues that host these types of games and kind of compare apples to oranges. Whereas, you know, when you look at a state like Washington, and it's like looking at a lot of these comments and diving into some of the comment sections of Scorebook Live's stories, and you just hear so often there's just this general frustration at, well, why can't we make this work? Why can't we make that work? Why can't it be this grand stage? And Todd, I think you're right. I think we do need to kind of give this a chance and see how these three sites work and if there would be perhaps more feasible sites in the future. But something that interests me is I would love to follow a fan, or at least get the experience of a fan who goes to all three sites throughout the day. They are meant to, the reason that the WI put them so close to each other is to have kind of that concentrated area where they trust that they'll kind of hit the ticket numbers, the ticket sales numbers that they have in past years. But is it legitimately feasible? I mean, what is going to be the best overall fan experience if you're the type of guy who goes from site to site to site? Given that the games are at 12 and 4 p.m., you know, there's two sites, and that probably only one of them is going to be on TV. Is that right, Todd?
Yeah, correct. I mean, and that'll be made at a later date. While the 4A championship game or the 3A championship game will be televised. But you're right. I mean, the person that sits in the Tacoma Dome, and the WI has data on this. The WI has seen that type of fan who goes to the Tacoma Dome for both games on Friday, comes back and sits through, you know, four more games on Saturday. That type of fan has, you know, along with the general decrease in attendance, that type of fan has also decreased. So yeah, while they're making it sort of feasible to get to whatever games you want, the fact that they're at three, you know, separate stadiums, 20 minutes from one another, but with the game times being at the same time, it's still going to be difficult. I mean, if you're a fan that likes to do that, I mean, best case scenario is, I mean, you get to a first half of one game, a second half of maybe another, and then you go see a third game. So you see, you know, bits and pieces of three games. You know, that's hard to do. So I mean, you know, they're not catering to the even though that they're giving the ability to get to whatever game you want, and then maybe get to another game. That's about it. I mean, two games max if you want to watch is sort of under the new model is about what a fan can expect to go see if that fan still exists. It's not perfect. If it was a one site, you know, like it's been in the Tacoma Dome, you could watch all six games. That's not going to happen this year. It's probably not going to happen next year. But again, the fan experience, as we talked about last week, is sort of relative. Let's see what emerges as the biggest factors for the best fan experience before we start judging and then we move forward.
Turning the page to week five of the high school football season, a theme on scorebooklive.com/Washington this week I found were stories about certain programs that went from a losing culture to now at least the early stages of experiencing some winning and what that took to rid the program of the culture that had established itself over so many years. Todd, you wrote about Pasco. I wrote about Ingram in Seattle, a story that's going live by the time this podcast is published. Todd, if you just want to touch base real quick on what Pasco's situation is this year. They're sitting here at 3-1. They've had a couple of real impact wins. Is this the turn of a page for the program, Pasco?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, we're in year two with Leon Jackson coming back. Leon Jackson Wright. I know him as Leon Jackson. He's one of the better running backs that have ever come out of the state. He played on Pasco's state championship teams back in the early 2000s and went on to play at Hawaii and whatnot. Well, he's come back, and you know, they're off to, like you said, they're off to a 3-1 start. And more importantly, they beat, you know, one of their, you know, their city rivals in Richland. And as we all know, Richland's kind of ruled the roost here over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years in the MCC, and then obviously as a traditional power as well. So have they turned the page? I mean, I'm not ready to take it that far, but for a team that's gone on 2 losing streaks over the last 5 years of 20 games or more, I mean, it's a great moment for them. And, you know, and so Leon Jackson, like I said, is a guy that's returned to his alma mater. He quickly adopted the Dabo Swinney all-in model that Clemson has used and has promoted, you know, over the last decade, and has really introduced that to his players. He said his guys have really bought into all that stuff. And in year two, you've seen him take a big step. Whether it's a turnaround, well, it remains to be seen. But like you said, the Pasco isn't an isolated incident. You've written something about Ingram. You know, Mount Vernon was a team last year. You know, these types of stories, teams that are having good years that maybe people didn't expect, are so much fun because there's so much energy and excitement from players, especially guys that have been so used to getting their butts kicked. You know, 1-9, 0-10 seasons. The fact that they've tasted a little bit of success, you can kind of feel and hear the energy in not only the players' voices but the coaching staff's voices as well.
Ingram's a great story. The program of Ingram had been referred to as sort of the doormat of Washington prep football, and that was something that was interesting through the lens of their quarterback, Connor Richardson, who grew up hearing about these two different eras of Ingram High School football. You know, the Ingram football that he grew up watching and grew up knowing was that had experienced one winning season since 1988. And then the era before that was the one his dad participated in when his dad was on the team in 1988 that won the state title. So here's this quarterback who comes up and is a part of this strong sophomore class 2 seasons ago when Zach Elvig, their now head coach, was hired. He played on the 2005 team. And Elvig was just kind of sick of hearing about how much Ingram sucked. He was just sick of it. And he would use this story written by and produced by one of the TV stations in Seattle that kind of offhandedly referred to Ingram as the doormat of prep football in Washington. And he would use that as bulletin board material. And, you know, the last 2 seasons leading up to this season, Elvig sort of said, okay, we're going to make this 2-pronged. We got to start from scratch. And first, we have to raise the standard in the classroom. And he's a PE teacher, so he said he kind of fell out of favor of a lot of the upperclassmen when he would make sure they were sitting in class and walk the hallways and check to make sure that and call kids out if they were skipping class. And secondly, the idea of the 5-weekers, or the term for students whose grades rule them academically ineligible but have that 5-week grace period to get their grades up, well, those guys under his program were no longer allowed to compete under that grace period. So you start with grades, and then he's established a weight room culture, which was advantageous being in building, being a PE teacher, and really getting a buy-in from a young sophomore class that are now seniors. And Richardson, of course, is the quarterback, but it's a pretty big class of 16 seniors that make up the core. And last season, they went 6-3, marking only their second winning season for the since 1988. Well, this season, they're off to a 4-0 start, and they didn't make the postseason last year, finished second in the Metro League Sound Division, one game behind Ballard. Well, they're tied going into league play with Ballard. This team is determined to make the postseason this year and really keep this thing going. And so it strikes me as, you know, these stories about teams turning the page and teams just ridding themselves of this of perennially losing cultures, it's not done in 1 year, is it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Andy, you're right. I mean, cultures don't happen overnight, whether positively or negatively. You know, a lot of it takes maybe one person spearheading the revival, so to speak, as a leader, or many times it's kind of a group effort. You know, I can kind of look back at my high school basketball experience at Prairie down in Vancouver and share the example of you know, how you can go from, I don't want to say we necessarily had a losing culture, but we had a not understanding of how to win and what it took culture, into becoming one of the best teams in the state my senior year. So my freshman year, you know, I played varsity as a freshman. We had a group of seniors that really didn't care whether they won or lost. All they cared about was, hey, give me my 8 shots, and I want to go hang out with my friends after the game on the weekend. Well, you have that, you're not going to be very good. Fast forward to my sophomore year, now the upperclassmen were friends of mine, and they loved the game of basketball, but they, for lack of a better term, weren't just good enough. And so we just couldn't get over the hump and win games. So, you know, my sophomore and junior year, again, we were about 500. But in between my sophomore and junior year, we had a change in the coach. Excuse me, after my freshman and sophomore year, we had a change in the coach. And you could start to see that the expectations and the thought process of, guys, we have to work and we have to expect to win, began to change. And then, like I said, my sophomore and junior year, we just didn't have the strength of players to really turn around the program at that point. Now my senior year, we finally had a group of guys that were bought into the philosophy that the newer coach brought. And that was, hey, we're gonna play summer leagues. We're gonna go to summer camps. We're gonna be prepared. We're gonna have open gyms. We're gonna do all the extra things that good programs do. And so it took 3 years, essentially the third year of the newer coach, in his philosophy of guys buying in, for it to kind of really start to turn the corner. And so then my senior year, we finally had a group of guys that were used to working and that were used to expecting to win and that wanted to work. And so my senior year, you know, there still wasn't a lot expected out of us, even though at that time I had signed with the University of Washington. We had a younger teammate of mine, Zach Gord, who ended up going to Gonzaga as well. You know, they thought, okay, they have some pieces, but, you know, they haven't won. So, we finally turned the corner culturally as a program and bought in, and then that third year, we really took off. We ended up, at one point, I believe we were ranked number one in the state at one point towards the end of the year. We lost in the semifinals of the state tournament in one of, if not the most heartbreaking loss still to this day of my career. But you're right in the fact that it takes time to change a culture in a program. Many times it's a coach. Many times it may be a student athlete who is a leader and can get guys to kind of follow their lead. And that was kind of my example. And to hear stories like Ingram, to hear stories like Pasco and the change, those are really cool to see. And I enjoy reading about those type of programs.
Well, you can find those stories now on scorebooklive.com/Washington if you want to dive in and learn more, which I would recommend doing. Now we're going to start a new segment this week that hopefully we'll do each week called Bring the Links. And so essentially what this is to end the show each week is myself, Dan, Todd, each of us is going to bring one story, a video, or a piece of media that we read that impacted us. Could be related to high school sports, could not, but overall kind of reflects the theme of the things we talk about in this podcast. So this week, my story is on the untold story of wrestler Andrew Johnson's dreadlocks. Now, this is a high school sports story that goes much beyond sports. It was written by the undefeated of ESPN. Jesse Washington was the writer, and it was written a couple weeks ago, or published a couple weeks ago, and it was about the high school athlete who endured the infamous haircut, whereas Andrew Johnson, a high school wrestler in New Jersey, was given the opportunity or given the choice to either forfeit his match or cut off his dreadlocks. And the story takes a really deep dive into that situation, which became kind of a really hot button topic at the time. It happened last year. And, you know, it takes place in a small town with a rich wrestling tradition. I'm reading from the article where people say that sports bring them together, even as they're further apart from most want them to believe. So I would recommend reading this story. It's one of the great examples that high school sports is and sometimes what we do is really going beyond the actual breakdown of the sport itself and what it tells us about some of the stories in life and the intersections that that athletics meet at the high school level with other walks of life. So highly recommend this story. I'll link to it in the show notes. Which one of you guys wants to go next?
Yeah, I'll go really quickly. So my story was on ESPN.com, and it's about Kansas City Chiefs head coach Andy Reid. And it kind of details a lot of the different steps in his playing career as well as his coaching career. And, you know, lots of different guys have comments or kind of little anecdotes, stories about ways that he impacted their lives or ways that or things that they saw he was doing that were either unique or different or impactful for, you know, a team success or their personal success. And it makes me quickly think back to some of the better coaches that I've had in my career. And you see how these connection points and with coaches really impact you and can set you up for, you know, so many positive things in the future that you don't realize in the moment you're in. I talked a second ago, you know, about my high school basketball experience at Prairie, and when we changed coaches, the new coach came in and really impacted the culture for the better. That high school coach, he's no longer in coaching. He's in the private business world, but he's become one of my best friends and a mentor, you know, that I talk to fairly regularly. So I just looked at this Andy Reid article and saw how cool it was that, you know, the impact that coaches at any level can have on the players that they coach.
Yeah, that's a great example, Dan. I look forward to taking a look at that. Todd?
So I'll bring it back kind of to kind of the state of Washington and a guy that I didn't cover a ton when I was at the Tacoma News Tribune, but was in our headlines a lot. His name's Mitch Geller, a three-sport standout, but he was a fantastic baseball pitcher and a quarterback at WF West High School in Chehalis. And he has a younger brother, Tanner Geller, who was also a standout in a few sports. Now, Mitch Geller was a first-round draft pick in the Major League Draft by the Philadelphia Phillies and had a five-year career, six-year career in professional baseball while his brother went off to Idaho State to be a quarterback. Now, Mitch Geller was, you know, unceremoniously just released by the Phillies. He never got to the major leagues, saw his baseball dream die. I mean, that's got to be deflating. He's in a different part of the country and just sort of sees it end. And then he gets a call from his brother, Tanner, who had talked to his football coach then, Mike Kramer at Idaho State, and said, hey, if this doesn't work out for my brother, what are the chances of him, you know, of us here at Idaho State welcoming him with open arms in a different sport? And his coach said, we'd love to have him. And so Tanner drove out to the East Coast and said, hey, I know one door is closed, but there's another one that's open for you if you're interested. And Mitch Geller drove back to Pocatello and got acclimated to a sport that he was familiar with but hadn't played in 5 years. And now, coming this week, Idaho State plays Portland State, and Mitch Geller has a chance to become the all-time leading wide receiver in school history. And I think that's a really cool story for a guy that started professionally in a completely different sport and had to kind of do a U-turn and come back to a sport that he loved dearly in high school as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. I'll link all three of these stories in the show notes. I'm looking forward to reading both of yours. You can subscribe to the Scorebook Live Today podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Apple Podcasts. Apple Podcasts is where you're going to want to leave a review and rate us. It helps us do what we do, and we'd love to hear your feedback. But for now, thanks for tuning in. We will see you next week. We'll be right back.